Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. The man rubbed his aching finger, trying to restore some life to it. That finger, the ring finger on his left hand, had hardly moved in years, not since it had been crushed under the hoof of a stubborn ox. His right hand crept upward, massaging his left forearm. It had suffered a nasty break in the heat of a fight, grabbed and twisted by an enemy, and never fully healed. He moved his hand up further, digging his fingers into the muscle of his shoulder, trying to loosen up the arthritic joint. He couldn't even remember exactly how he'd hurt that one. All of it was futile, as much an unconscious habit as an action intended to elicit a real response. Giving his frozen finger one last rub, he stood up from the charred stump that had served as his seat, brushing little bits of dried meat out of his long gray beard. He shouted at two boys shaking sticks at one another, one around 5 years of age and the other 8 or 9, warning them that the bull grazing near them in the meadow had a nasty temper. The herd of cattle, dozens of head, chomped and lazed in the long grass, basking in the warm sunshine. Pungent wood smoke rose from the cook fires, gray curls snaking in between their tents and their wagons beyond. Several women, accompanied by droves of other children, milked cows. One of the men, younger than the battle-scarred graybeard, was working on retouching a flint arrowhead. The older man stopped and peered into the forest surrounding the meadow. He thought he'd heard something, a snapping branch or a footfall. Propped against a wagon, his axe was sitting nearby, a thick piece of sharp ground stone attached to a short wooden handle. The fingers of his left hand were closing around the haft, the frozen one still sticking straight out, when he heard a scream and the crack of breaking pottery. The woman had dropped her container full of milk as she walked back toward the tents. Her hands were instead wrapped around the arrow shaft sticking out from her ribs, bright red blood spreading outward onto her woolen clothing. A second arrow followed it a split second later, whizzing through the air, slamming into her torso, and burying itself almost to the feathers. She fell without another sound. The children near her were silent for a moment, and then they too started to scream. The air was suddenly full of arrows. The man ducked down behind the wagon, his fingers clutched around the axe. That was when he saw them emerge from the tree line. Young men, a dozen of them, wearing thick belts but naked from the waist up, all of them armed with clubs, axes, and bows. The graybeard screamed at everyone to run, to get away, but not in time. The older of the two boys he'd warned about the bull fell to the ground, struck on the head by a raider's club. He didn't get up again. Howling in fear, the people in the meadow ran toward their tents and wagons, toward the tree line behind them, in safety. But it was not to be. Another hail of arrows met them, and a dozen more raiders emerged from the woods. They were trapped. The graybeard met one of the raiders head-on, swinging his axe and crushing the younger man's skull with practiced ease, but three more came behind him. He again yelled at the others to run, and desperately tried to block a club with his right hand, but he felt his fingers shatter as the weapon struck him. Another raider tripped him to the ground. He dropped his axe, reached for it with his left hand, and then felt those fingers crack as one of the attackers stomped on the hand with his heel. He looked up, just in time to see the blade of the stone axe descending toward his head. And then he saw no more. It was all over in just a few minutes. A few of the younger men and older children had gotten away, but their compatriots weren't as lucky. 13 people were left dead in the meadow. Mothers and fathers, children and grandparents, all of them now gone. The raiders hooted and hollered, high on adrenaline and drunk on beer and victory. After a few hours, they led their stolen cattle away through the forest. The few survivors waited for darkness and safety before returning. There was a lovely spot nearby overlooking the river. That would be a good place to bury them, they thought. 4,600 years ago, this little band of herders, members of a group known as the Cordedware culture, was killed all at once near the village of Eulau in Saxony. People who knew them and the relationships that mattered to them found the corpses and buried them together. They remained in their graves undisturbed for the next 46 centuries until archaeologists found them in 2005. These people who met such a violent and tragic end were victims of an age of upheaval and transition. Herders whose ancestors had lived on the Eurasian grasslands were moving west into Europe. They fought the Neolithic farmers who already lived there, and they fought each other. But in the process, they created the cultures of the Bronze Age, and they left behind legacies in their languages and genes that remain in place all the way to the present day. And also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge comes out on July 20th, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I'm narrating, of course, from your distributor of choice right now. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Enjoy. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Around 5,000 years ago, as the wagons of the Yamnaya people were rumbling past the Carpathian Mountains and into the Danube Valley, another stream of migrants was heading west from the steppe. Instead of the open expanses of the Danube River Valley and the Hungarian plain beyond, these people, herders, young men mostly, entered the thick forests and hills of northern Europe. They moved on from pasture to pasture, then went further and further still, eventually reaching as far west as the North Sea coast of Belgium. In so doing, they brought their language, almost certainly a dialect of Proto-Indo-European, and their genes into Europe, where they remain to this day. These herders formed what archaeologists know as the corded ware culture, from their distinctive pottery, impressed with a cord when still wet and pliable, and found most of all in their earthen burial mounds. As with the movement of the Yamnaya into Europe, which we discussed in our last episode, cutting-edge archaeological and scientific tools allow us to understand the migration of the corded ware people in exceptional focus. We can examine their DNA, the isotopes in their tooth enamel, the patterns of use and trauma in their bones, the spatial distribution of their graves, and much more. When put together, all of these things paint a coherent portrait of a long-term and complex series of migrations covering 1,000 miles and half a millennium. We can understand the gender and age dynamics of the migrants, something of their social structure, how they interacted with the people already living in the places to which they came, and even how they changed the landscape as they moved. The fact that we can understand the movements of these people 5,000 years in the past in such granular detail is mind-blowing. Even more than that, though, we can understand these migrants and the people with whom they interacted as people. The herders we met at the beginning of today's episode, the people who died and were buried with such care near the town of Eulau in Germany 4,600 years ago, were real. Their lives were real. Some things about their existence will of course be lost to us, but their humanity, their aches and pains from old injuries, their terror at the moment of death, doesn't have to be one of them. This is what we'll talk about today. One specific instance of migration from a world without writing in as much detail as possible, and where we can, trying to understand the people involved in the process. So let's start with a really basic question. What was the corded ware culture? In our last episode, we talked a lot about how easy it is to go wrong when trying to tell a comprehensive story about the deep past from different lines of evidence. It's really tempting to equate a population in the genetic sense with a speech community that spoke a particular language with an archaeological culture. But archaeological cultures, like the corded ware culture, are abstractions. They're analytical tools created by archaeologists to help us understand the mass of varied evidence pulled out of the ground. They're not an objective description of lived reality 4,500 or 5,000 years ago. Archaeological sites aren't cookie cutter in the first place. We tend to lump sites together as belonging to particular cultures if they have one or more diagnostic things like pottery or a house type, but reality is much messier. Culture is polythetic. It consists of multiple elements like speech, hairstyle, perceptions of ancestry, and yes, pottery and houses. Our access to that world through archaeological means is limited. Our tendency is to make culture monothetic, defined by a single characteristic or element simply because that's what we can see in our evidence. But that's extremely misleading. On top of that, it's not like the presence of a type of pottery with cord impressions or a semi-underground house or a burial mound automatically means that you spoke a specific language or belonged to a particular breeding population of people. If we're going to actually understand our evidence and the past reality that it gives us some hazy access to, then we've got to understand its limitations. Your bathroom soap doesn't necessarily speak to your ancestry. Your language isn't determined by the shape of your house. As we discuss the cordedware culture, we have to bear this in mind. It's not a self-contained bowling ball of breeding population, language, and cultural traits rolling across the landscape over the centuries, crushing everything in its path. In fact, archaeologists usually break it into several regional subdivisions: battle axe culture, single grave culture, and so on. We're talking about archaeological sites that show significant diversity over space and time. The genetic and isotopic evidence shows us some really surprising and fascinating things about social structure and relationships between individual people and smaller and larger groups. Just remember, that label is an abstraction. Reality was a lot messier. So again, what was the cordedware culture? The simple answer is that it's an archaeological complex that seems to spread from east to west starting around 3000 BC or a little after. That's a little bit, a couple of centuries, after the Yamnaya migrations into the Danube Valley and the Hungarian Plain that we talked about last time had begun. When I say east to west, the cordedware complex begins roughly at the northwestern fringe of the Eurasian steppe in what's now Ukraine, where the largely flat grasslands begin to give way to forest and mountains. From there, cordedware sites spread to the west with shocking speed, into Poland, Germany, Scandinavia, and the Low Countries along the North Sea, all within a couple of centuries. That's really, really fast in archaeological terms. It meant that people were on the move, potentially covering significant distances over the course of their lifetimes. It meant that ways of life were changing. Languages were spreading and falling out of use. Groups from very different backgrounds with very different lifestyles were coming into contact with one another. And new paths into the future were being born. What exactly was spreading? The most obvious feature was a burial rite, a particular way in which groups buried their dead. When we talk about cordedware archaeological sites, that's usually what we're describing. A cemetery, either a single burial or a group of tombs that shared common features. This specific burial rite is also the most obvious connection to the steppe, the thing that's made generations of scholars think that the cordedware culture was connected to the Proto-Indo-Europeans and their spread into Europe. That's because the typical cordedware burial was an inhumation of a single individual, usually a man, under an earthen mound called a barrow. Some of these barrows were quite large, others were just little piles of earth. These barrows show up both individually and packed into rows in large cemeteries, and the basic technique was shared over huge distances. From the North Sea coast of Belgium and the Netherlands to Sweden and Finland to Poland and Ukraine. The deceased was placed in a particular crouched position. Men were usually buried on their right side with their head to the west, women on their left side with their head to the east. Men were often buried with a battle axe. Pottery impressed with a distinctive cord pattern gives the culture its name, the cordedware culture, and these pots were often found in graves. If this reminds you of the Yamnaya and their kurgans, good job, because that's exactly what scholars have been thinking for the last century or so. As archaeological techniques have improved, we can add more evidence to that baseline observation about cemeteries. We get a sense for their lifestyle, the way they altered the landscape, how they found marriage partners, and so on. But burial rites shared over a vast area, which spread very quickly in chronological terms, remain the defining feature of the cordedware culture. So this is the schematic version of the cordedware culture. If I'd been writing this episode 10 or 15 years ago, it would have been a pretty solid summation. But precisely because of the complexity and quantity of our evidence, we've got to tell a more complicated story. There are areas that have cordedware pottery and weapons, like the coastal Netherlands, but exactly zero of those distinctive burials. There are regions with hundreds or thousands of the distinctive burials that have barely a trace of any other cordedware material culture, like the inland Netherlands and central Germany. There are a couple of places where cordedware pottery is found in graves of an entirely different type, in old-style megalithic tombs like the Danish islands. There's one area a little bit later and on the steppe that has both settlements full of cordedware materials and the distinctive burials. The regional variations of the cordedware culture have different names and characteristics. the battle axe culture in Scandinavia, the single grave culture in Jutland, and so on. What are we to make of all this? Was there even a corded ware culture at all? Clearly, we're not dealing with a simple cultural bowling ball here, where people picked up from one spot and moved to another, or many others, with their way of life set in stone. There was something more complicated happening. We're going to get to the bottom of it.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Ancient DNA has already revolutionized our understanding of a whole bunch of aspects of the human past. But DNA doesn't speak for itself. We have to apply statistical methods of analysis. We have to pick reference populations. We have to plot the data, and then we have to interpret it. Combining ancient DNA with other bodies of evidence is a tricky process. It's one that archaeologists and geneticists haven't yet fully developed. For periods when we have no writing, like that of late prehistory that we're discussing here, it has the potential to be the foundational body of evidence on which we base our understanding of what happened. That's the case here with the corded ware culture. An older generation of archaeologists assumed that it represented the migration of Proto-Indo-European speakers from the steppes into Europe, and that they carried a coherent material culture with them. At first glance, the evidence we glean from ancient DNA would seem to straightforwardly support this. Human remains found in corded ware graves often have high levels of that distinctive steppe ancestry that we talked about with the Yamnaya last time. Seems pretty straightforward, right? We've got burial practices that look like they developed from antecedents in the steppe, and we've got ancient DNA that tells us the populations were either extremely similar or even identical. So far, so good. People moved from the steppe into northern and central Europe and buried their dead in ways they remembered from their homeland, in ways that were reflective of the identity they wanted to present to the world and posterity. They carried their language with them in the process, leaving it and their genes behind in ways that still resonate today. But as we've discussed in prior episodes, migration can look very different from place to place, group to group, time to time. Did they make long jumps over hundreds of miles or short hops a few miles at a time? Are we talking about whole family groups composed of children, women, and men? Or war bands made up entirely of young men? Were these migrants conquerors or refugees? Did they integrate seamlessly with the existing inhabitants, assimilating to their culture? Or did they displace their way of life by killing the people and burning their villages to the ground? All of these things are possibilities. So are the many intermediate points between these extremes. Establishing that people moved, which is what the ancient DNA evidence tells us, is only the very beginning of the process. In the centuries on either side of around 5,000 years ago, communities of Neolithic farmers tended their livestock, planted and harvested their fields in the eastern reaches of Central Europe, between the Elbe and Dniester rivers. They knew their neighbors to the east, the steppe people like the Yamnaya, and they may have picked up some habits from them, like occasionally burying their dead with cattle. But they weren't related to the people of the steppe, as far as their genes can tell us. Instead, their ancestry went back to the Neolithic farmers who had migrated into Europe more than 3,000 years before. Their pottery was quite distinctive, especially the big round pots they used. The name archaeologists have given them, based on these distinctive vessels, is the globular amphora culture. One group of these farmers, people with relatively dark skin, brown eyes, and dark hair, lived near what is now the town of Kosice in southeastern Poland. They belonged to an extended family group, one organized around the male line. All of the men belonged to the same Y chromosome haplogroup, I2A L801, while the women came from a variety of different maternal ancestries. But around 5,000 years ago, something terrible happened to this group of people. They were killed, murdered, in fact, all of them with vicious blows to the head. As far as we can tell, this wasn't the result of an open battle or a skirmish between groups. There are no perifractures or defensive wounds. The most likely explanation is that they were captured and executed, and the corpses were left behind. At some point soon after that, the dead were then carefully buried in a mass grave. One mother cradled her child, another was buried next to her teenage daughter and five-year-old son. Half-brothers with the same father and different mothers were buried next to one another, older men were mostly absent from the mass grave. Perhaps they were the ones who returned home to find their kin dead and then buried them with such care. This was not the same group of people we met at the beginning of today's episode who lived in what's now Germany, but a different set of victims. Earlier, further to the east, and from a different cultural background, farmers instead of herders. We'll never know exactly who killed the Neolithic farmers of Košice. There are no smoking guns in this mass grave. But we can guess, because a little ways to the east of Košice and the globular amphora culture, a new wave of migrants seems to have been leaving the steppe and heading west into central and northern Europe. The first early roots of the corded ware culture. Now, this is just a hypothesis, mind you. It's also possible that someone committed familicide, or the people in the mass grave were the victims of a ritual intergroup killing. But it seems much more likely to me that a group of aggressive newcomers from the steppe sought out their rivals for local resources and land, and then killed them. That's because this specific area in what's now southeastern Poland seems to have been one of the heartlands of the new corded ware culture. Maybe its initial home before it spread further west. The corded ware pottery is distinctive for the cord-like impressions that decorated it, but in shape, it was really, really similar to the big, round pots of the globular amphora culture in Poland. These cord-impressed pots are later found all across the region that we call corded ware in greater and lesser numbers. So, one of the other pieces of the corded ware material package are battle axes. They're distinctive, even diagnostic. If you've got an axe and a burial under a mound, that's corded ware. But let's go a ways further to the west, to Jutland, the peninsula sticking up north of what's today Germany that contains part of Denmark. Like southeastern Poland, it too is one of the corded ware heartlands. It has thousands of these single grave burials. One of the things that's really common here are those distinctive battle axes. These must be imports, right? They must have come with the migrants, ultimately from the steppe. But in fact, it seems like these battle axes, which, like the pottery, show up all over the corded ware region, actually first developed there, in Jutland, and then spread in all directions from this particular homeland. The earliest corded ware graves in this region have no battle axes and no pottery, just the distinctive burial rite of a single person in a crouched position under a mound. This bit about the axes and the pots is something we can tell thanks to really large-scale studies of radiocarbon dates associated with corded ware finds. They give us exceptionally fine chronological resolution for things that happened almost 5,000 years ago, the product of exactly that kind of granular detail I talked about earlier. So it turns out that aside from the burials, the most distinctive pieces of corded ware material culture, diagnostic things, the cord-impressed pottery, and the wickedly sharp axes, didn't actually originate on the steppe at all. The pottery developed out of forms that had been common among a steppe-influenced but genetically separate group of Neolithic farmers in Poland. The axes were invented in Northern Europe, probably by the descendants of migrants, and then spread east. When I say that you can't treat culture as a bowling ball with self-contained populations with distinctive traits rolling from place to place across the map, this is what I mean. The different parts of what we might call the corded ware package show up in different places at different times. If these are the things we can see, imagine what we can't. All of this means that the process that created the package can't be understood solely as one of mass migration out of the steppe. So let's try to grasp some alternative models here, something a bit more in line with the sophistication of the evidence at our disposal. Again, we know that at least some people were on the move. That genetic profile that has so much in common with Yamnaya samples from the steppe didn't magically show up in burials in Jutland, Germany, and Scandinavia, and it didn't move on its own. People must have carried it. We can be fairly certain that those people took with them their distinctive way of burying the dead, under a mound, in a particular crouched position, and that they had a specific way of life, probably involving mobile pastoralism. These weren't farmers who stuck around in one place to plant and harvest grain, but herders of cattle and sheep who moved from place to place. This is the baseline of evidence we have to start with. So let's try to tell a story to fit that evidence. I want to stress that this is just one interpretation. It's as up-to-date as I can make it. It accounts for as much of that evidence as possible, but it is still an interpretation. As new evidence is published, I expect this story to change. But anyway, let's give it a shot. Somewhere on the Pontic-Caspian steppe, maybe eastern Ukraine, maybe just north of the North Caucasus foothills, lived a particular group of people. Their lifestyle was probably much like that we associate with the Yamnaya culture we discussed last time. highly mobile, based on herding animals and probably some hunting and fishing on the side. Wagons and probably horses took them from place to place. When they died, they might have aspired to be buried in a kurgan, one of those large earthen mounds that served as focal points in the landscape. But we know that steppe societies of the late 4th millennium BC were pretty hierarchical places, with sharp divisions between those at the top and those below. This group probably wasn't sitting at the top of that hierarchy. The men of this group were mostly related to each other. They were descended from a common male ancestor a few generations back. There may not have been that many of them, maybe just a few hundred or even a few dozen people. Probably more like an extended clan than a tribe. At some point around, or probably a little bit after 3000 BC, they started to move north and west, following the great river valleys of Ukraine, north from the grassland and into the increasingly dense forests of northeastern Europe. Why? Maybe this group tried to fight it out with another steppe clan for pasture land and lost. So they fled their homeland rather than staying behind as underlings to the victors or to be killed. Maybe they were tired of being below the big men of the steppe, those guys who got buried in kurgans with their fancy funeral feasts, and decided to try their luck in a different place. We know that this was a mobile culture where movements of people over long distances were perfectly normal. That's how kurgans and other pieces of material culture and genetic ancestry that we associate with the Yamnaya culture were already showing up in the Danube Valley and on the Hungarian plain around this time. Others had left the steppe before, others would do so again, repeatedly, in the future. So the grasslands were seeded behind them. Who was them? Probably younger men, at least at first, maybe scouting ahead on predatory raids, maybe driving their herds to look for new pastures. Others seem to have turned to the west, following the northern edge of the Carpathian Mountains, where they curve into southern Poland, toward Kraków. This would have been where they encountered the farmers of the globular amphora culture, perhaps including the unfortunate victims buried near Košice. Whether the land they found was unoccupied and well-suited to their way of life, there's some evidence to suggest that the populations of Neolithic farmers around this time had already declined, or the newcomers displaced the prior farming residents, these herders established themselves in their new territories on the fringes of the steppe. If the earliest migrants were predominantly men, some whole families probably followed before long, turning a pioneering movement into a larger migration. Perhaps it was here, in a new land with plenty of space available for them, that their numbers exploded, dozens turning into hundreds and then thousands. As their numbers grew, they didn't stop there along the eastern edges of Central Europe. Some of them kept going further to the west. As they moved, they didn't lose touch with their cultural relatives back in the east or with the other migrant communities to which they were connected. They didn't ignore the existing Neolithic farmers, and the farmers didn't ignore them either. The result was a complex melting pot, a series of networks connecting migrants to existing communities of farmers, and some migrants to each other, even over huge distances. This new fusion, this new set of relationships in a new land, was what the corded ware culture actually was.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
In the early stages of this new set of population movements, just after 3000 BC, the migrants were probably fairly simple folk. These don't seem to have been the elite of their originating society, taking with them the fanciest items of material culture, or even a complete version of that culture. Migrants never do, because they're not a representative sample of the society from which they come. Instead, they tend to be drawn from particular regions, ethnic or tribal groups, occupational groups, and family lineages. The genetic evidence tells us that the corded ware migrants belonged to a fairly restricted group, probably something like a clan, organized around the male line of descent. The Y chromosome haplogroup R1A, and particularly its subclade R1A M417, which is passed from father to son in direct lines of descent, is commonly found in human remains associated with corded ware burials. The simple explanation for this is that a group of closely related men who bore that specific Y chromosome haplogroup inherited from a common ancestor, were at the heart of the Corded Ware expansion. There's no real doubt that this expansion came from the steppe. That particular haplogroup has been found in a much earlier set of remains from Ukraine. And looking outside the Y chromosome to the whole genome, the Corded Ware samples share significant ancestry with Yamnaya, both on the steppe and Yamnaya migrants in Europe. The earliest dated Corded Ware burials in Poland and Germany under those distinctive earthen mounds include little in the way of archaeological material. But a hammer-headed pin, identical in type to those found in burials on the steppe, is an exception. The geographic range of the earliest Corded Ware sites, all of them burials rather than settlements, tells a very specific kind of story about what this expansion was like. The mounds usually appear in clusters, often widely separated from one another over space. The burials take the form of that earthen mound with a single man buried underneath. When sampled for ancient DNA, the human remains often but not always have that Y chromosome haplogroup R1A, M417, and high levels of steppe ancestry across the whole genome. But we don't see the distinctive Corded Ware pottery, we don't see the battle axes, or anything else that seems typically quote-unquote Corded Ware at this stage. The best explanation for this is that these people were jumping from place to place, often over huge distances, dozens or hundreds of miles, in relatively brief periods of time. No more than a century to go from the Ukrainian steppe to central Germany, north into Belarus, and then toward the Baltic Sea beyond. That's fast. Not unexpectedly so, since we know the Yamnaya expansion into the Danube Valley and Hungarian plain was quick, but this may have been even faster, and it was into a kind of environment, forests and hills, that did not match the steppe. It was certainly more rapid than the Neolithic expansion into Europe had been a couple of thousand years before. We have to imagine a society constantly on the move, herds of cattle and sheep being driven over hills and through forests in search of new pastures. There's no reason to assume these migrants were all or even mostly peaceful. Some of them probably raided into new regions to the north and the west, looking for plunder, and in the process stumbling on fine new pasture land. Younger sons especially would have been heavily incentivized to do this, since herding was so land-intensive and inheritance was limited. Where those pastures didn't already exist in the heavily forested landscape of northern Europe, these migrants created them. The environmental record provides evidence for massive burning in several places, like the western part of Jutland, in precisely this period of time. Elsewhere, in Switzerland, the landscape may have opened a bit more slowly, with natural meadows and regularly burnt pasture replacing the forests. We can imagine these people moving ahead of their herds, setting fires a year or two in advance, and then letting the landscape regenerate with grasses and new growth before they brought their herds into the new pasture to graze. Voila, you've got a huge swath of suitable new ground for your way of life. Rather than a rolling mass of migrants, we have to understand this movement in terms of relatively small groups. Dozens or hundreds at the most, rather than thousands. They occupied the islands of suitable pasture or created new ones, leaping over the unsuitable territory in the interim. Some of them succeeded, like those who arrived in Jutland on the North Sea coast around 2800 BC. Others died violent deaths. At Tiefbrunn in southern Germany, three people were buried together in a multiple internment. An older man who, according to the isotopes in his bones, had arrived in the region from elsewhere. The young adult male and female child, around 4 years old, were local to Tiefbrunn. All of them had suffered severe head trauma that led to their deaths. It's not hard to imagine that existing communities of farmers might not have been happy about the new arrivals, and violence was likely to result. But not all of these interactions were necessarily violent. Thanks to deep investigations of ancient DNA and the isotope ratios in bones, we can tell a lot about the ancestry and movements of people associated with Corded Ware artifacts. When we do this, we start to see a really striking pattern. A huge difference between men and women in ancestry, childhood diet, and place of origin. The men were disproportionately carriers of that distinctive R1A haplogroup that ultimately derived from the steppe. The women, by contrast, were much more likely to have mitochondrial DNA haplogroups and genome-wide ancestry associated with the Neolithic farmers who had already been living in Europe for millennia. In other words, herder men had children with farmer women. This pattern shows up over and over and over again throughout the region where we see Corded Ware sites, over hundreds of years, and it grows more pronounced the further west we go. As we reach Germany, Jutland, and the North Sea coast, there are practically no mitochondrial DNA, female line haplogroups, associated with the steppe. They're basically all Neolithic European. But the male Y chromosome haplogroups are still extremely skewed toward that steppe ancestry. When we combine the genetic data with isotope analysis, the pattern grows even clearer. We see men whose immediate ancestors had migrated to the region, but they then put down roots and stayed put. They claimed their pastures for their livestock, they built their earthen mounds and buried their dead, and they stuck around. The isotope signatures in male remains from corded ware type burials tend to be local. But these second, third, and later generation migrants went outside that local area to find mates. The women with whom they had children often seem to have come from nearby communities of Neolithic farmers. The childhood diets of these women were noticeably different, probably with more grain and vegetables and relatively less milk and animal protein, which we know because of differences in isotopic signatures when we compare their tooth enamel to that of men. The basic conclusion we have to draw is one of female exogamy. Men were local and women came from elsewhere. There are at least three different explanations for this obvious pattern of exogamy, which aren't mutually exclusive. Now, first, it's likely that at least some of these women didn't leave their homes by choice. It's not hard to imagine how bands of mostly young migrant men might make a habit of abducting women from nearby sedentary communities. On the other hand, given that at least some of the existing Neolithic farming communities were organized along patrilineal lines already, they may have simply incorporated the herding newcomers into that framework. If the migrants were there to stay, one way of ensuring peace between separate communities was to integrate them through marriage. Finally, as we get deeper into the corded ware period around 2500 BC, we can see that different communities had different diets depending on where they lived and what was available. Some of them grew more grain, others cultivated lakeside gardens, others fished and hunted, and some relied entirely on the animals they herded, the classic corded ware pattern. As time went on, we can see that different corded ware communities continued their practice of exogamy, with women leaving their home communities to marry, even after the cultural boundaries between farmers and herders had effectively ceased to exist. We're talking about a cultural practice that continued even after its original reason for being had disappeared. So as I said, we're probably looking at some combination of all of these explanations, and presumably others as well. The incorporation of women from a dramatically different background, especially early on, meant that the eventual path of the corded ware culture was one of fusion rather than straightforward importation of practices from the steppe. The earliest corded ware burials had no pottery. The first generations of migrants probably used leather or woven bags instead of ceramics. Pottery wasn't common for people living a highly mobile pastoral lifestyle. Whatever you make, you have to carry with you. They preferred other kinds of containers, and the pottery buried in Yamnaya Kurgans, for example, usually came from elsewhere. But the women in these early corded ware communities came from a world where pottery was common, like those of the globular amphora culture we talked about earlier. The corded patterns of decoration from which the corded ware culture gets its name was an imitation of the cords that held woven and leather bags together. Thus, this distinctive pottery was a meeting of two worlds in physical form. The shape, almost identical to that of the Neolithic globular amphora people, and the decorative patterns from a distant world of people living in wagons on the steppe. Once these communities were established, spreading north into Scandinavia and west into Central Europe and then Germany and the North Sea coast, it's not like they stopped innovating or fell out of contact with one another. On the contrary, the corded ware pottery seems to have spread west and north from southeastern Poland until it became common everywhere. The battle axes that defined a warrior identity for corded ware men, by contrast, seem to have been invented first in Jutland, at the very western edge of the region in which we find corded ware sites. From there, they spread south, east, and north until they too were ubiquitous across this whole region. The origins of the final item that was common across the whole region, beaker-like pottery vessels used for the consumption of fermented alcoholic beverages, are harder to pin down. But they too didn't come from the steppe. Their closest antecedents are probably to be found in Neolithic communities of Central Europe rather than among the Yamnaya. So instead of picturing a wave of migration moving west and north out of the steppe, bringing with it a fully formed cultural package, we should instead imagine something much more fluid and smaller in scale. These groups, little family units and larger clans and bands of young male warriors, jumped from place to place. They kept in touch with one another as they moved. We know this because of the continuous diffusion of new cultural traits throughout this whole region. Communities remained connected to one another. Not every community to every other community in the Corded Ware world, from Finland to the Netherlands and Switzerland to Poland, but to specific other communities within the network. Marriage, ancestry, trade, and probably conflict bound them together. This wasn't a peaceful world, and we have to assume that Corded Ware communities fought one another in addition to the Neolithic farmers among whom they lived. This brings us back to the people we met at the very beginning of today's episode, the unfortunate souls who were slaughtered and buried in the mass grave at Oylau some 4,600 years ago. The arrowhead embedded in one of the dead wasn't of a Corded Ware type. It instead belongs to a type associated with the Schönfeld culture, a farming group with its roots deeper in the Neolithic. Maybe they were competing for resources in an age of increasing population. Maybe the attack that killed the people was revenge for the abduction of women from a farming community. Maybe it was a generations-old feud rooted in deep, adversarial cultural differences. We can't know. But we can be certain that friction accompanied movement and the introduction of new people and a new way of life. But it didn't have to be that way. Elsewhere, as along the North Sea coast and at some places in Jutland, Corded Ware pottery and weapons begin to show up in settlements associated with existing farming communities. Rather than a genocidal takeover or even much long-distance population movement at all, cultural change may have been slower, more a product of time and choice and fashion rather than conflict and migration. Movement can take many different forms. Migration is just one kind of movement, longer in distance and duration. But movement of all kinds is what makes our worlds. Going from your house to a grocery store, from the city you live in now to the place where you grew up, from one place to another on a business trip or a trucking route, across the country or out of it on a permanent long-distance move. These are all forms of movement. The Corded Ware world was no different. Travels to see a cousin or uncle in another herding community maintained cultural ties and linguistic affiliations. Going to see your mother's relations in a farming village brought axes and pottery in, fermented beverages, and grain back. Raids brought back information about what lay over the horizon. And the wagons rumbled on, going from known pasture to known pasture or to an entirely new place. Migration only exists in the context of those other kinds of movement, those other kinds of connections. This influence and movement wasn't just in one direction, east from the steppe into Europe. It moved back, too, as with the axes and beakers for drinking that went from west to east. People moved and kept moving. The initial wave of Corded Ware migrants bypassed the whole region of Moravia in Central Europe. They only showed up there around 2580 BC, probably coming from the west rather than the east, centuries after their ancestors had skipped over it and continued going west. The easternmost extension of the Corded Ware world on the fringes of the Ukrainian steppe, called the Fatyanovo culture, was actually a product of back migration from further west. The Fatyanovo people were probably at least in part the group ancestral to the later speakers of Indo-Iranian languages. They kept moving east, and still further east, until they reached Central and even South Asia many centuries later. There were no straight lines here. There were no brick-like packages of culture and ancestry and language that traveled across the landscape, obliterating everything in their path. People could move in many different directions, behave in many different ways. Sure, there was plenty of violence in this world. We've encountered a bunch of different mass graves, surely the product of inter- and intra-group violence in this period. But we've also seen cultural integration and fusion between migrants and long-established residents, broad cultural similarities across vast distances of space, and the diffusion of new ideas from the fringes back to the cultural heartland. That is the story of the Corded Ware culture. Multi-directional, complex movements of people, practices, and ideas that we're only now beginning to understand thanks to the miracles of new forms of evidence. Next time on Tides, we'll continue with our discussion of Indo-European topics. In the closing centuries of the 3rd millennium BC, as we get toward around 2000 BC, a new phenomenon swept Europe everywhere from Britain to Poland, Iberia to Scandinavia, the Bell Beaker culture. What was the Bell Beaker culture? Was it a new religion, a conquering ethnic group, a way of life, or something else altogether? Stick with me and we'll find out. Until then, thanks for joining me. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about today, go to patrickwyman.substack.com, where I'm posting pictures and videos in a post to go along with each episode. I've written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook that I'll be reading, naturally, from your distributor of choice right now. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick, or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. And if you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review.
I'm Trey Wingo. And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect.